Hello, Saints. Well, last time we looked at Genesis chapter 32 about Jacob wrestling with the angel of the Lord, and he had that encounter where he was left all alone, no one but himself, and he wrestled with the angel of the Lord. He wrestled with him all night, and God in the end had to touch him physically and give him an injury. But he also changed his name. And that's such a good passage of the encounters that we have to have with our Lord Jesus Christ. So the next little piece we're going to look at today is from Genesis 33. And Jacob still hasn't faced his biggest fear, which is his brother Esau. So when we get to chapter 33, he's about to come face to face with Esau, and it comes after this wonderful night and this wonderful experience where he had met God face to face, and God had asked him his name, "What is your name?" And he had to be honest about who he was, and God changed his name. But even with all these great experiences, great spiritual encounters that we can have with the Lord, it always has to be backed up with our behavior. It's not just enough to have all these experiences, spiritual as they may be. Sometimes you can have the greatest experiences or have the most intimate and spiritual times with the Lord, but yet a failure is right around the corner, and the two have to match up. So when we get to chapter 33, Jacob is going to have to meet his greatest fear, and that is his brother. How will he respond? Well, we'll have a little look at that at the moment. So you would think from an encounter that he had just had with the Lord, wrestling with him all night, he had had all the wonderful promises from God. He met the angels on the way, and he wrestled with the Lord, and the Lord changed his name, and he recognized that he had met God face to face. You'd think that his behavior would be somewhat different. But we still see the same themes in Jacob's life, that of fear and that of distrust and trying to work things out by his own agenda and his own means are still really dominant in his life, even though he's had these wonderful experiences with God. So all of these have to be worked out. So in chapter 33, we'll start reading. Now Jacob lifted his eyes, and he looked, and there was Esau coming, and with him were 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. And he put the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children behind, and Rachel and Joseph last. So straight away, here we have Esau coming with 400 men. Here comes a problem, here comes a challenge. And Jacob's first reaction, remember, he's just wrestled with the Lord all night, and he's had this encounter with God. You would think that he would be believing enough for God to take care of the situation, to take care of the circumstances. But straight away, we see Jacob doing the same old things. He's dominated by fear, and he's dominated by unbelief. He separates his household. He divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. He put the children in front, then Leah and her children behind, and Rachel and Joseph last. You've got to feel sorry for poor old Leah. Remember back when she was given to Jacob, all she actually wanted was the love of her husband, but he loved Rachel. And here he is here ordering his household almost from the least to who he loves the most. And poor old Leah is put down the line again, her and her children, and Rachel is put at the end with Joseph, the apple of Jacob's eye, last of all. But poor old Leah, if Esau's going to come and attack, she'll be the first one that'll be knocked off before they get to Rachel and Joseph. So he's doing the same old thing. He's ordering things how he thinks will best benefit him or best benefit the situation, rather than actually just committing the whole thing to God and letting God take care of the situation. So verse 3, he crossed over before them, and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. So what the custom of the day was, you would walk forward, Jacob would hop down on the ground and he would bow down to the ground, put his head on the ground. Then he would stand up, he'd walk a few more steps, he would hop down again, bow down to the ground, stand up. So he did this 7 times, so it's quite a long procession to actually do that. He's doing this all before his brother Esau. And Esau's response is very different to him charging in there with 400 men. Who knows why he bought 400 men? Maybe he didn't know what he was expecting from Jacob, or it was just a show of strength, or who knows. But he came with 400 men. But in verse 4, you see this, but Esau ran to meet him, and he embraced him, and he fell on his neck, and he kissed him, and they wept. Very different response from what you'd expect. It shows that God was actually working on the heart of Esau. He hadn't seen Jacob for 20 years. And when he last saw Jacob, he threatened him. He was going to kill him. But now, 20 years later, everything that Jacob had been afraid of, God had actually been working upon the heart of Esau. Because in Esau, you see, he makes every effort for reconciliation. There's nothing, he holds nothing toward his brother. He ran to meet him. It almost pictures almost like in the story of the prodigal son and the father. You know, the father was always looking away off, and he ran to meet his son when he returned home, and he fell on his neck and kissed him and brought out the robe. And Esau's the same thing. He is over the moon to have his brother back in the land. He runs toward him. He embraces him. He fell on his neck, kissed him, and they wept. So you see a very different situation to what Jacob thought might happen. He obviously was so afraid and fearful of his brother Esau that he expected really just a show of strength. But the heart of Esau actually shows true reconciliation here. And it made me question, sometimes is it easier to actually get over a wrong that's done to you, or whether you're the one that's actually done the wrong, to actually forgive yourself? Sometimes when somebody does something to you, forgiveness is actually easier for us to actually give, because it's something that is done to you from outside of yourself, and you can actually forgive the person. But sometimes when we do the wrong toward others, sometimes it's actually really hard to forgive yourself, or there's guilt attached to the wrong that you've done. So in here you see every effort made by Esau, but Jacob not so much. So in verse 5 he says, and he lifted his eyes and saw the woman and children and said, who are these with you? So he said, the children whom God has graciously given your servant. Then the maidservants came near, they and their children, they bowed down. And Leah also came near with her children, and they bowed down. And afterward Joseph and Rachel came near, and they bowed down. And then Esau said, what do you mean by all this company which I met? And he said, these are to find favor in the sight of my Lord. So in other words, Jacob is still trying to earn his acceptance by his brother. Instead of just trusting God, he's still trying to earn it. And Esau said in verse 9, I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. And Jacob said, no, please, if I have now found favor in your sight, then receive my present from my hand, inasmuch as I have seen your face as though I had seen the face of God, and you were pleased with me. Then Esau said, let us take our journey, let us go, and I will go before you. But Jacob said to him, my Lord knows that the children are weak, and the flocks and the herds which are nursing are with me, and if the men should drive them hard one day, all the flock will die. Please let my Lord go on ahead before his servant, and I will lead on slowly at a pace which the livestock that go before me and the children are able to endure, until I come to my Lord in Seir. And then Esau said, "Now let me leave with you some of the people who are with me." But he said, "What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord." So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. Jacob's first failure was right at the start when he let fear and unbelief dominate him. But his second favor is here with Esau. In verse 12, Esau says, "Let us take our journey, let us go, and I'll go before you back to my place." You see in the heart of Esau that he actually wants reconciliation with his brother. And there's a lot of us's in there. But Jacob has no intention of actually going back with Esau. And he actually lies to him. So his first failure was really the fear that dominated him. The second failure was that he actually lied to his brother. He said, "My Lord knows that the children are weak." And Esau says, "Look, I'll leave some men with you to help you." And Jacob fobs him off and pretty much says, no, that's not needed. We'll follow on at our own pace." But he had no intention whatsoever of going anywhere near Esau or his homeland. So he lies to his brother. So when you look at these two characters, the Bible talks about Esau as being profane or godless. But when you see this little passage here, it actually shows him in a light where he wants reconciliation. He's happy to see his brother. He wants him to return, and he's even going to leave men with him to return. But Jacob has no intention. He's still afraid of his brother. He still doesn't trust him. He still doesn't want to be where he is. And I don't know whether it's just that he's dominated by a fear of Esau being a man of the field, a man's man, or whether there's guilt with Jacob and all the acts that he deceived his brother out of the birthright, he stole the blessing, all of those things, whether there's actually guilt attached. It's hard to know, but it's a possibility because he's really untrusting of his brother. He has no intention of going back. He may have had guilt, but he certainly feared him. But we know that guilt can actually be a real hindrance to someone who is actually, if you're the one that's done the wrong, sometimes it's really hard to get over the wrong that you did, to actually forgive yourself and to know that that person can actually trust you again. And the scriptures are full of people that actually felt that. Think about Peter with his great boasts of, "All else will betray you, but not me. You know, I'm made of sterner stuff than everybody else. There's no way I will betray you," or those things to the Lord he spoke, only to be quietened by a girl around a fire and hear the rooster crow. And Peter took a lot of restoration because of that failure and the guilt that came with it. And the Lord had to assure him, you know, after the resurrection, that he still had plans for him, that failure, and he needed to let that guilt go by. Paul, as a persecutor of Christians, I think that they always hung with him, that he was the one that actually put Christians in prison. He would say of himself, "I'm the least of all the brethren." And I believe that it took a lot for him to actually forgive himself for the wrongs that he did. So it's a possibility. I'm not saying it is, but it's a possibility that something in Jacob, he doesn't want to reconcile himself fully to his brother. But Esau, on the other hand, in this passage, he shows he wants reconciliation. So Jacob had no intention of actually going back. And even in verse 15, Esau said, "Now let me leave with you some of the people who are with me." But he said, "What need is there? Let me find favor on the side of my Lord." So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. So Jacob said he was going to follow along at a slow pace. But what did he do? Instead of following Esau and his men back to the land of Seir, he went sideways and up. So he pretty much went in the opposite direction of where he said he was going to go. And when you get to verse 17, now Jacob journeyed to Succoth, built himself a house, and made booths for his livestock. Therefore the name of that place is called Succoth. So instead of being a tent dweller, he built himself a house. He wasn't going to be journeying back toward where his brother and his father were. Instead of camping, he decided to build a house, and he made booths for his livestock. He's not going anywhere. He's setting up permanent dwellings. He's gone the other way. Now, this Succoth, it means booths, and it was really close to another place called Shechem, and all of this speaks about another little sojourn that Jacob ends up taking, and that is, God had always said to him, way back in Padam, I am the God of Bethel, return to your homeland. Now Jacob, this area here, Succoth and Shechem, was about 30 miles from Bethel, the house of God, where he first met God. And it's not until we get to chapter 35 that God actually intervenes into the life of Jacob again and says to him, arise, get out of this place and come back to Bethel and there build an altar. So you've got Jacob taking this little sideways detour. He didn't go back down to his brother, and he didn't go to where he had first met God in Bethel, but he settles down in Succoth and in Shechem for some scholars say for a period of about 10 years. And what this speaks to us about, saints, is the little detours that we can take in our Christian lives that seem right at the time, but actually have consequences. Now this place, Succoth and Shechem, it was a rich, fertile land. Partly the reason why Jacob would have seen it. He came out with much livestock and they had needs. Bethel was a dry, barren place, but God was there. That is where he met God, and when he dreamed about the angels ascending and descending upon the ladder, there wasn't really much in Bethel at all, but God himself was there. But this other place, Succoth and Shechem, outwardly, it was a beautiful place. It was rich, it was fertile, it had everything for the crops, but was it the right place for him to be in? And it all speaks to us of these little detours that we can take in our Christian lives. And sometimes they can be for 5 months, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, sometimes even 20 years. And they can be these little detours off the narrow path that God has called us on. It all looks fine, but it has consequences. And this little 10-year sojourn for Jacob has consequences, as we'll go on and look. This almost speaks similar to what happened with Lot and Abraham. In Genesis chapter 13, if we read from verse 5, Lot also, who went with Abraham, had flocks and herds and tents. And now the land was not able to support them that they might dwell together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abraham's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, and they also dwelt in the land. So Abraham said to Lot, please let there be no strife between you and me, and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brethren. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If you take the left, then I will go to the right. Or if you go to the right, then I will go to the left. Abraham's faith here is amazing. He's leaving the allotment up to God, that God would actually, he knew the promises of God, that he would be with him, that he would bless him, but he's allowing Lot to take the pick. And Lot lifted his eyes in verse 10, and saw all the plain of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go towards Zoar. And Lot chose for himself all the plain of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. And Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and he pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. But the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Lord. So you see in this little passage the same thing. What attracted Lot was the well-watered, fertile plains of the land, that it was going to be good for him materially, that it was going to be good for his possessions. But the warning is actually given. Yes, it was good for that, but he actually pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. So there was an outward, there was consequences to the decisions that he made. Yes, the land was great for his crops, but the influence of Sodom and Gomorrah was right on his doorstep. And we know that as you follow the story forward, the trouble that he gets into being in Sodom and Gomorrah. And yes, the Bible does talk about Lot as being righteous, but it had an effect. It had an effect upon his family, and it had an effect upon his daughters, and it had an effect upon his wife. And all of these things come from the decision that he chose, I'll choose the best of the land. But the best had some consequences, and it bit him in the backside in the end. Whereas Abraham, he allowed God to actually choose for him. So in the same way, Jacob did the same thing. Instead of traveling back with his brother, which he had no intention of doing, or going on to where he first met God at Bethel, he takes this little sojourney, and he chooses this place, Succoth, to actually set up a house, make booths for his livestock, and stay there for, I think, a period of about 10 years. And it has consequences. It's almost similar to, there was two tribes, the Reubenites, Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh, when they were journeying from Egypt through into the promised land of Canaan. When they got through the Jordan area, they saw a whole heap of land that was so good for their livestock and for their cattle. And they struck up a bargain with Joshua. They were willing to come and fight for the nation of Israel, that they could enter into their inheritance, but they didn't want their inheritance on the other side of the Jordan. They didn't want their inheritance by which God had actually said, I was going to give you the land. They were happy to fight. They were happy to be a part of the spiritual progress of the nation, but their home was to be on back on the other side of the Jordan, because the land was really good for their cattle, for their sheep, for crops, for fertile land. So all of this speaks about that sometimes as Christians, yes, we can be involved in the Christian plan, but our heart really is back on the other side of the Jordan, where the fertile land is. It's better for us. It's better for our livelihoods. It's better for our professions. And we need to be aware of all of these types of decisions. Jacob, he's picked this land because it's really good for his sheep, for his cattle. And he spends 10 years here. So, where are we? Chapter 17. So Jacob journeyed to Succoth, built himself a house, made booths for his livestock. Therefore the name of the place is called Succoth. And then Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. And when he came from Paddan Aram, and he pitched his tent before the city, and he bought the parcel of land where he'd pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money, and there he erected an altar and called it El Elohi Israel. In other words, the God of Israel. So he erects this altar and he calls it after the name that he had been given. God has said to him, your name is no longer going to be Jacob, but I'm going to call you Israel, which means Prince with God or Prince of God. So he erects this altar there and he calls it the God of Israel. Now that my name has been changed, God is now more personal. In times past, when people had encounters with God, they would build an altar. And it was always that way. For me myself, I'm unsure about this act. God doesn't direct him to actually build an altar here. Jacob builds this altar himself and names it after himself. And I'm not sure why. I know when you get to chapter 35, when God does appear to him, he tells him, get back in verse 1, get back up to Bethel and make an altar there to God. So I'm wondering about this altar that he erects in this place, because it's not God directed. It seems to be something that Jacob does, and whether it's sometimes we try to justify the spiritual decisions that we make, or the decisions that we make, and sometimes we can spiritualize those decisions as though this is all of God, but really, in our heart, we're doing it for material value, we're doing it for material reasons, we're doing it for life can be a lot easier and more comfortable in this area that we're going. So, yeah, I'm unsure. So Shechem, he ends up in Shechem, and I think he's about 10 years, so there's no passing through. He buys a piece of land, he builds a home, and builds an altar. He had built two altars, but it all speaks really of almost a self-religion, or justifying the decisions that he has made. So when you get to chapter 34, this is the result of a little detour in your life that camps down after a period of about 10 years. I reckon Dinah was potentially 6 when Jacob left from Laban's household, and the only daughter that Jacob actually had, Dinah, and they think that she's now about 16 years of age. So that's where they get this 10-year sojourn from. So we'll read a little bit of this and see it, because it's quite a nasty passage, or the Bible doesn't hold back in events that happen. So now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. So right there, the Holy Spirit is giving you a little insight into something that is going on. Why would she be going out to look at the other daughters of the land? Remember, what they are doing, Succoth and Shechem, they are dwelling with the Canaanites in the land. So they're not their own people. They're people that they were not to mix with, not to be a part of. And here she's going out to see the daughters of the land. Sounds like a typical teenager, almost rebelling in the way that she's been brought up. And she's going to have a look and experience what the world's got to offer. In verse 2, and when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her. So this is rape. So one of the consequences of Jacob's daughter is that she goes out to have a look what's going on, and she gets seen by someone that takes a fancy to her, and he rapes her. In verse 3, his soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke kindly to the young woman. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this young woman as a wife." And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with the livestock in the field, so Jacob held his peace until they came. And then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. And the sons of Jacob came in from the field, and when they heard it, and the men were grieved and very angry, this is Dinah's brothers, because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not to be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife, and make marriages with us, Give your daughters to us, and take our daughters to yourselves. So you shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade in it, and acquire possessions for yourself in it. Do you see what is going on here? Jacob should have been back at Bethel, but he takes this detour. One of the consequences of this detour was that his daughter was raped. The other consequence was that Satan is always trying to bring about an unholy and an unrighteous mixture. And for here, he was trying to bring about a mixture between the Hivites and the Israelites, the people who God had chosen, being mixed with the Hivites. And this is always Satan's plan, that there be a mixture. We are called to be separate. We are called to be pilgrims. We are called to be saints. We are called to be untainted by the world. But he, on the other hand, always wants us to be, there to be a mixture in our lives, a mixture of worldliness, unholy attractions, unholy unions, because he knows that if there is a mixture there, there will be compromise there in some area. And Jacob is just about taken into this. He's just about taken into this. If this had gone through, there would have been a mixture in the house of Israel. They would have taken their sons and they would have taken their daughters. The whole land is before you. Take whatever you want, the Shechem had said. So this is always the plan of the enemy, and it's something that we need to be continually aware of. Yes, we can have these little detours in our lives, but there is always a cost. And for Jacob, this cost came close to mixing themselves with the Hivites. But let's read on, because the sons, or Jacob's sons, Dinah's brothers, are actually end up getting guilty of premeditated murder, and it's quite a nasty. Actually, we won't read it because it's all the rest of the chapter. But what it goes on to say is that Jacob's sons deceive these people. They say that you cannot be joined to us unless you be circumcised. But it was a plan and it was a trick by Jacob's sons. And what they did is Shechem, he actually loved Dinah, even though he had raped her. They agreed for all of the men to be circumcised, and then after they had circumcised, while they were still trying to heal, Jacob's sons came upon them with the sword, and they killed Shechem, they killed his father, they killed everybody, and they took all the little ones, they took all their wives as captives, they plundered everything that was in their houses. They did all of these things with premeditated murder and everything else included. So it's quite a mess. But the picture is of Jacob taking this little detour. He shouldn't have even been in this place. He should have been at Bethel. He should have been at the house of God. But he wasn't. He was looking after his livestock because it was a fertile, rich land. And out of that, just came premeditated murder, it came the rape of his daughter, and it came a period of his life where God almost was put to one side as he set up homes, built booths, and bought land. And it all speaks about that we need to be careful continually about spiritual drifting from the Lord. Now, our culture bombards us always to get more, to better yourself. Get that over there, that's going to be far better for you. And these things can be, but they sometimes always come at a cost. We are called to be separate unto God, called to be saints, aliens, pilgrims. This world is not your home. You're just passing through, as Larry Norman quite often sung about. Romans, a couple of scriptures, Romans 12, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed. Actually, I'll just read it. Romans 12, all these verses that we know. I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Hebrews 2:1 talks about give earnest heed. Where's Hebrews? Lest we drift. Therefore, we must give the more earnest heed to the things we have heard, lest we drift away. Drifting away is so easy. Just a little detour here, a little detour there. It's so easy. The enemy can take a foothold as easy as anything, and we just drift. 1 minute you think you're in one position, and then the next minute, before you know it, you've moved. For Jacob, he had moved. This is a period of 10 years for him. But he's so like us. We can have little driftings away, little times when we think things are going to be better or easier. And then God has to step in and call us back to himself. 1 John says, do not love the world or the things in the world. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, all of these things are of the world. So this little passage is all about that. Jacob takes this little sojourn in chapter 33 and chapter 34. And there is a cost to his daughter, a cost to himself, a cost to the sons, because they're guilty of murder of all the people of the land. And when we get to chapter 35, God steps in to his life, as he does with all of us, and he has to call him back to the things that really matter, call him back to himself, and call him back to his first love, call him back to Bethel. See, Jacob should never have been in Succoth and Shechem, but the land was good. He should have been at Bethel. And as soon as God turns up in chapter 35, arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there. That's where he should have gone. When he came out of Laban's land, God kept reminding him, I am the God of Bethel. I am the God of Bethel where you first met me. But Jacob, he wasn't quite ready. So just as Jacob has had these little detours, we are exactly the same saints, and we need to be fully aware that we are all made of the same stuff, all made of the same weakness. But he who began a good work in you, as Philippians says, will carry it on unto completion. And I'm really grateful for chapter 35, because God steps in again and has to say to Jacob, come back to me. Return to your first love. So when the next little passage that we'll look at is chapter 35. And you've got in this chapter, you've got almost like the sort of first revival, but you've got truths that are always true about how we return to God and what we need to do in returning to him. So that pretty much sums up 33 and 34. I love the way that God is always dealing with Jacob. And beware of spiritual experiences, how great they are. Jacob wrestled all night, but yet he can turn around. He can have that encounter with the angel of the Lord, yet he can turn around straight after that and act as though someone who doesn't believe in God, that has no faith, that is doing what he wants when he wants. And God allows him to do it. God allows him this 10-year period, and he will do the same for us until we learn by failure that we need to trust God wholeheartedly, and we need to follow the leading of his voice and be obedient unto his word. So 35, when we get there, which isn't Far Away is a great little chapter because it's all about returning. So I pray that some of what we've looked at may be of benefit to you today, and that God would show you more in these two chapters. So God bless, and amen. Chapter 35 is on its way. God bless.